Succession number 25197, Reel 8.
Sylvia, the small child, in with her because she was worried that the rats would attack the children she was staying.
I suppose it was very cold, was it?
Very cold, yes. Well, even in the good months of the year, the Atlantic is cold at night. And there's usually a breeze. That's the other thing. There's a cold wind. And one extraordinary event took place while we were actually in that period when we were actually sleeping on the sports deck. One night, we had with us a man and his wife who had been good friends of my parents in Singapore. His name was Roy Oxley, and he ultimately became the chief set designer for BBC after the war. He was an architect by training, and he was on that ship, in that ship, and on that particular night he was sleeping, as it were, in the next bay, next to my mother. So it was my mother, there was me and my mother, and then Roy, and then his wife, and so on. And it was the middle of the night, early hours of the morning, and my mother suddenly became aware that all the lights on the sports deck had been turned on. Now, of course, all ships were blacked out. And she sat bolt upright and saw a man standing just across the other side of the sports deck where the bank of main switches was mounted on the wall. And he was turning all the lights on. So she shook Oxley awake and said to him, look. He jumped up, they both jumped up and ran after the fellow, who dived down one of the companionways and ran along the corridor, and they cornered him in his cabin. And then, of course, went back and turned all the lights off. But, of course, that was deliberate act of sabotage. And he was put in to the cells. I think most big ships like that have a couple of prison cells. And he was put into the cells.
End of Reel 7, Derek Bartlett. Reel 8, Derek Bartlett.
My mother said that that was probably the most frightening thing that happened in the whole journey. Because if those lights had been left on much longer, I don't think we would have survived. And when one thinks about, you know, that man was willing to sacrifice that ship and probably would have been picked up by the U-boats, you see, at some stage or other. And we'd have gone to the bottom of the Atlantic. So it was very traumatic, really. And the worst of it was seeing other ships torpedo, because one naturally, and this was going on every day, and sometimes at night, one would see a ship suddenly explode and sink. And of course, inevitably, one stands there thinking, well, when is it going to be us? So that was really, I think, probably the worst experience we had. But the escorts were wonderful. You know, the Canadian and American escorts, there were men risking their lives every single hour of the day, virtually, trying to protect us. But they were stretched to the limit. There were too few of them, and there were many U-boats. And then when we got to the other side, of course, the 1,000 miles on our side here, the UK, we had British corvettes and warships doing the same thing. But these convoys were enormous and covered a vast area of sea. And of course, it was very, very difficult for a handful of warships to protect all those ships.
A sight, isn't it, to be in the midst of a convoy?
Yes, tremendous, yes.
I suppose it must have been a bit of a mix for you, wasn't it, Derek? You know, you've explained so well this anxiety, this nagging worry all the time, and yet the interest for a young boy, was it?
Oh, it was exciting, certainly. And when the crew were trained, while we were in New Orleans, of course, the crew had been trained in firing all these weapons. So they used to carry out practice exercises, and they even used to let us, you know, just very occasionally we were allowed to sit there and pull the trigger. So from their point of view, I mean, it was all terribly exciting. And in actual fact, I can remember standing on the rail and watching a Canadian destroyers going past and dropping these depth charges. Tremendously dramatic, you know, vast columns of water going up all the time. And they did get some U-boats, there's no doubt about that. So from that standpoint, yes, it was, for a boy, it was of that age, it was very exciting indeed, yes. But at the same time, there's always this thing at the back of the mind, you know. And of course, the warships were equally vulnerable. Some of those were torpedoed as well, not just the merchant ships. So I don't think we would necessarily have been any safer if it actually been on a warship.
But I suppose knowing you had all the ammunition on board as well, that. No, I wonder if that went through your mind, if you would have been aware of the
Yes, I think I was, really, because there were a lot of servicemen on board, and we got to know them fairly well. And I can remember being taken round by one of the Air Force officers who was explaining to us, you know, what bazooka shells and all these other weapons were for, hand grenades. Boxes of grenades, you see. We were told very, very strictly indeed that we were under no circumstances to investigate any boxes of ammunition. The temptation was there, all right, because they were only strapped down. I mean, one could have got into them, but they wouldn't. There would have been a heavy penalty for messing with those. But what interests me particularly, or does now, is the way that they managed to pack all these aircraft onto the decks by taking off the wings and strapping those to the fuselage, so that the space the thing occupied was actually quite small. And then they were all sandwiched very tightly together. So they managed to pack an enormous number of things, for example, like gliders, which were used in the invasion, and also the big tank landing craft. We had those on board as well, yes. What is significant now is that, and of course I didn't know it then, they were already preparing for the invasion, even in 1942. That's what those landing craft were for.
Seems that it was very tightly packed, that ship.
Yes, it was indeed. It would have been a massive prize for a U-boat, and not just in monetary terms, almost irrelevant. The sheer value of the war materials on that ship to us over here would have been phenomenally high, and that's of course why the U-boats were so keen to sink ships like that. Yes.
So arriving in back in Britain, really, for you, this was in Scotland, you say?
Yes, we came to Greenock from Reykjavik, where incidentally we passed icebergs. And of course, again, you see, we didn't have the clothing for it, because the temperature went down. And we didn't have any clothes, we didn't have clothing for it. Very cold.
Well, what was the... how long were you in Iceland?
Matter of a few days.
Yes. What did you see there? When you arrived?
Just the harbour. We weren't permitted to go ashore.
Yeah. No. Was it? Did you see defences? Was there any signs?
Don't remember it. No, I vaguely remember a town, a group, you know, buildings grouped around the harbour. That was all. Didn't see a great deal of it. Didn't go ashore. I don't know why we were there. But then you see in the middle of the Pacific, for example. A similar sort of puzzle. We were making progress one day as usual. We were sitting on the sports deck doing something or other, and suddenly the ship stopped. Now, when you're in a ship where you're crossing an enormous expanse of water like that, you become accustomed to the subdued noise of the engines. You know, it just becomes a background thing. And we suddenly realised they'd stopped. And after a few minutes, a submarine appeared on the surface, only a matter of 300 yards away. We thought it was Japanese, turned out to be Australian. Officer and two ratings came across in an inflatable, went up to the bridge. Obviously, it was a rendezvous. They came back after a few minutes, went down to the inflatable, and once they were back on the submarine, prepared to dive, gave us a wave, went down below, and she dived. I can't tell you to this very day what that was about, but it was obviously a pre-arranged meeting.
And that was on your way across the Pacific?
Yes. And it was a frightening thing too, because if the ship stops and then suddenly a submarine appears, our natural assumption was that she'd somehow or other got a grip on us, is it? We thought it was Japanese, but it wasn't. It was just one small incident. So, yes, we got back to Glasgow from Reykjavik, and it was the autumn of 1942 by that time. And we came back to Bexley, to Plumstead, and pushed in with my mother's relatives for a while.
Now, this was autumn 1942. Mm. What was the situation then regarding raids?
Air raids?
Yes.
In that part of London, I think air raids had... the Blitz was over, of course, and the air raids had... it had abated to some extent. There were air raid warnings from time to time, but I don't recall anything very dramatic.
What was it like being in England? You know, you have explained you had very vague memories before of the country, but I wondered, you know, you were coming back to wartime England, weren't you?
It was a foreign country to me. Apart from the fact that everybody spoke English, but then most of the people I knew in Singapore spoke English. Or rather, should I say, the European people among whom we moved, they all spoke English. So there was no difference in that sense, but everything else was completely foreign to me.
You were coming back to a time of rationing, weren't you? After, say, you know, comparing it with the United States.
Oh yes, it was very tough indeed. My mother wanted to stay in the States, but I mentioned earlier that it was a disadvantage to be funded by the Air Ministry, because she went to the British Embassy. There was a representative there, and she managed to get in touch with them and ask them if they would accept our staying in either New Orleans or another American city, you see, instead of going back to the UK. And she told me that they said to her, "We are responsible. We have undertaken under your husband's contract to take you back to the United Kingdom. Now you don't have to do that. You can stay in America if they will accept you. But if they do, and you decide to do that, we no longer are responsible for getting you back to the UK, and we're no longer responsible for providing you with any income." Now, I said to her, "Did you actually seriously consider staying?" She said, "Yes, I did, but the problem was that the sort of job I'd had in the United Kingdom was not necessarily available there, and I couldn't do anything else." And she said, "You know, what I feared was literally being penniless in New Orleans, you know, and having no way of getting home." So she didn't actually want to come back. But at the end of the day, she did the practical thing, accepted the situation, and we came back here. But I know that neither of my parents ever wanted to come back here again, because what they had planned to do, my father told me after the war, he had planned to do three tours of duty each of 3 years, which make 9 years. Now that would have taken me to 12, you see, and European school education in Singapore took boys and girls up to 12, and then they had to either come back here or go to Australia or whatever. They had planned to emigrate permanently to Sydney at that point, and if the war hadn't occurred, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now. But it didn't work out.
So how about your education at this stage? Because you had missed quite a bit, hadn't you, with all this travelling?
I didn't go to school from the time we left the school in Cameron Highlands in December of 1941 until the round about the middle of the autumn term 1942, so it was getting on for a year. I was quite behind.
So did you went to school in Plumstead, did you?
No, I didn't go to school in Plumstead while we stayed there. We were there only about 3 weeks, living with my mother's brother, and then my father managed to obtain a rented house in Bexley Heath, which was a requisitioned house because the owners were in the forces overseas, and we lived there until 1946. And I went to school in Bexley Heath.
When did you go to Fife?
1944.
And was that because of the Doodlebugs?
Yeah.
But could you tell me about that? You know.
Yes. In passing, I would just simply say that I think both at school and in the local shops, I was seen as somewhat mentally retarded.
What, in Bexley Heath?
Yes. Because I couldn't get hold of the currency system. In Malaya, it was dollars and cents, you see. And my mother used to say to me, I want you to go up to the shops. This was near the station in Bexley Heath. And I want you to get me the following list, you see, list of vegetables and so on. And you're going to give him this, and he's going to give you threepence change. And I hadn't got the faintest idea what it was about. I used to hold the money out. I think he really thought I was dim, you know. I just didn't know anything about it. And at school it was the same, because we used to get... I was very good on spelling bees, for example, because our education in Singapore was actually quite good. But I was absolutely hopeless when it came to a question of, can you add 1 3 farthing plus 2 7/3 farthings? It didn't mean a thing to me. So that was not very happy, really.
And how about getting on with the other boys? Was that...
A bit tough, because I think they thought I was rather, what shall I say, I'll use a good old English word, snooty.
Would this have been because of the way you spoke, or...
That's right.
The different experience...
Well, I went to private schools all the time up to that point, and they were like good private schools here. Many of those boys in Bexley Heath came from very varying backgrounds. Yes, I think I was seen as rather snobbish, and put it bluntly. But then I was just being me, in the same way that they were being themselves. And I spoke with a slight Australian accent, which didn't go down well either. Well, it sort of came and went, my Australian accent. My mother tried to get rid of it, and she used to tick me off. But I'd picked it up so thoroughly in Australia that it used to, especially if I got angry, and even now, before I retired, one of my colleagues said to me, I don't know whether you noticed it, but if you're really upset about something and you're on the phone, this Australian accent emerges. He said, have you lived in Australia? And I said, oh, yes, I have. And it comes out when I get cross about something, you see. And that's what used to happen then. If somebody annoyed me, I'd start speaking with this accent, you see. It was rather funny, rather strange. And I don't think they could make a head or tail of that either. So it wasn't a very happy period. No, not really. And then we went up to Scotland to escape the V1s.
Did you have any experience of them before you went?
Oh, yes. We were living in that part of Bexley Heath, which is near to the railway station. And at first, they came over perhaps one or two a day. But by the time it got to the spring of 1944, they were coming over every hour and a half, every couple of hours. Oh, yes. There was, at one point... when we went to Scotland, it was almost like having a continuous air raid warning. The siren used to sound and then it would be nearly all day before the all clear went. I can't remember exactly, but I've got a document here which I purchased a long time ago, which was published specially, and I think I'm correct in saying that in a matter of a few months at the height of this period, something like 2,400 of these things came over in a matter of a few weeks. And I can remember sitting in our garden. We had quite a pleasant semi-detached house in a garden in Bexley Heath. And I can remember sitting with my parents in the garden. We were having a couple of tea or something. And just watching these things going over our house.
Did one ever drop near you?
Fairly in the Broadway. Broadway was only about, half a mile away, I suppose. And they used to drop, yes, they used to drop quite regularly.
Were they particularly frightening, the ones?
I was at school in Bexley Heath, at a school which was near the Broadway, and it was a 1930s building with a very steep pitched roof, and it was built on the principle that the more fresh air for children get, the better. So the windows were designed in such a way that they could fold back and leave a very big opening in the wall, which was very pleasant on a summer day. It was a nice thing. And we were sitting there one day, and we had actually got the windows drawn back. It was the early, I'll say late spring, I think, would have been 44, when these things first started. And we were sitting there in the classroom with the windows on our left, and our teacher was a very young woman, probably early 20s at the most, and she was saying something, and one of my classmates said to me, "Miss, look, and in the distance, coming towards us, was this black dot. We thought it was a German aircraft. Now, this was in the early stages when people weren't accustomed to them. So we didn't know what it was really. We thought it was a traditional aircraft, and then it was travelling quite fast and became bigger and bigger. And of course, then we realised it was one of these flying bombs. And she said, "Oh dear, it's a doodlebug," and it was coming straight towards us. And then the engine cut out. And it started to dip, because as soon as the engine cut out, it would no longer be flying on a horizontal path. It would begin to dive. And it began to dive towards the school, and particularly towards the classroom which we were occupying. And she said, "I want you to take your coats off, boys. Get under your desk and put the coats over your heads and faces." Now, children in those days tended to do what they were told in school. So we did. And then she was wearing, ladies in those days would wear little cardigans, you know, little knitted cardigans. She took that off. She got underneath her own desk and put that over her head. And the boy who was sitting next to me, he nudged me, you see, because boys being what they are, we were all looking out of the window. And this thing came and it passed over the school, the ridge at the top, the ridge of the roof, so closely. We could actually hear a whistle as it went over. And somebody who was standing outside in the playground at the time told me later that it probably passed over the roof no more than about 25 feet. It landed, fortunately, on the other side of the classroom, on the right side. There was a corridor. And then there was the schools in those days used to have enormous playing fields. You know, we had a couple of football pitches, a running track, two cricket pitches, a very big green area. It landed in the middle of that and exploded, of course, and it blew a hole in the ground big enough to drop a car into.
So it did fall in the school ground?
Oh, yeah. And if there'd been a football match or something like that going on at the time, well, it might just have done a lot more harm. But that was really... That was the early days, of course, when they were coming over just sporadically. And it was some time before my parents decided to send us up to Scotland. Yeah.
And would you have had any experience of the V2s as well?
Yes, they were already beginning to fall by the time we left for Scotland, they were definitely coming over here. Oh,
what
yeah.
was the difference between a V-1 and a V-2?
Well, the V-1 was a flying bomb with wings like an aircraft, really, powered by a rocket motor. And it was pilotless, of course, and it was set on a course and then fired, and they didn't know exactly where it was going to drop. But a V-2 was quite literally like a space rocket. It went up into the stratosphere and then down and came down vertically. And, of course, the point about them was they were more frightening in a way because they were very fast and silent and invisible. And the first thing one was aware of was an enormous explosion. No way of predicting or getting out of the way. You could, with a V1, one had a chance of, you could at least have a chance of getting out of the way. But with a V2, there was no chance at all. I was in the Broadway on one Sunday morning with my father. We were walking down the Broadway, and I suppose probably about a quarter of a mile away, there was a sudden flash and an enormous explosion, and three very large Victorian houses disappeared. They were very powerful. And my father said to me, "You just imagine, if we'd been another quarter of a mile down the Broadway, you and I wouldn't be here now." There was just a bang, and it was there. There was no warning. They were more frightening, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, I have read in subsequently that Churchill was much more worried about them because this country was beginning to suffer very greatly from the attack by the V2s.
Was it sort of more worrying for morale than, say, the
yes,
Blitz, that
yes.
that sort of bobbing
oh,
where
yes.
you saw
yes.
planes?
Yes, because if you can see something, you know, you feel you've got a chance, perhaps, of getting out of the way. But if this thing's coming down at a, I don't know what the speed was, but, you know, hundreds of miles an hour, vertically down, and just explode, you're not even aware that there's anything coming until it actually hits. And these three very big Victorian houses that were at a place called Crook Log, at the, I think it's the, yes, it's one end of the Broadway. It hit the centre one, and the other two just collapsed with the blast. It demolished three big Victorian houses in one blow. And they were beginning to cause a lot of problem, yes, with morale.
And this was leading to, this is why you left for Fife, was it?
Yes, that's right. Yes,
that.
Yes.
So this is the end of Reel 8, Derek Bartlett. Thank you.